This is Average Joe Finances Podcast, episode 37.
And, you know, to be honest, I think I learned why the mafia used to burn down buildings for insurance, because in both cases, while I didn't intend it, the properties, you know, it was much better for me once they burned down, because you get all your rent covered while they're rebuilding the property. I get a brand new building. In one case, we couldn't build a new building, but we paid off the loan and sold the land. So in both cases, it was profitable. You know, again, not telling anybody to burn down a building, but it's but all of these things that are sort of nightmare scenarios to a lot of investors are usually not as bad as you think.
If you're watching this on YouTube, make sure you smash that like button and click subscribe. For those of you listening on a podcast platform, be sure to subscribe on whatever platform that is and leave us a rating if you can. The more likes, ratings, and subscriptions that we get, the more we can spread the message and grow our community. So we also have a free Facebook group. It's called the Average Joe Finances Network. Check us out, join the group, join the community, ask questions, and become a part of the team. All of our other social media accounts are listed in our flow page, and we have them in the video or podcast description below.
Welcome to the Average Joe Finances Podcast. Are you trying to get out of debt, invest, or just not sure where to start? Then this is the place for you. We discuss different ways to get out of the rat race and build your wealth. Join us on this wild ride to financial freedom.
Hey, how's it going, everybody? So today we have with us the real estate ninja all the way from Japan, Daniel Mills. He's a university professor. He lives in Japan. He's been there for the past 14 years, and he moved there when he was around 30 years old. When he moved there, he only had he had $15,000 in debt, and he was earning about $30,000 a year. He now has a job that he loves, and he's built a net worth over $1 million through index funds and extreme long-distance real estate investing. I don't know what that is. I want to find out. So, hey, Daniel, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Absolutely, my pleasure. So, hey, the first question I want to ask you is the same question I ask everybody, and we want to know about you. So if you could just share a little bit about your story and, you know, just tell us about yourself.
Yeah, so I actually come originally from Southern California. And I actually joined the Marine Corps right out of high school, but it was a very short-lived. Unfortunately, I got injured while I was still in boot camp, and I ended up getting an honorable medical discharge. I was in for a little bit less than a year, and I after that happened, I had a whole plan of what I was going to accomplish, you know. Through the Marine Corps, I was looking at like federal law enforcement after this type of thing. And it just all kind of fell apart. So I spent a lot of my 20s not really focused, not knowing what I was doing. So I, you know, it took me a long time to graduate from university. I graduated at 28. Like you said in the intro, I had $20,000 in student loan debt. But luckily, I had a car that I sold. So I had $5,000, so $15,000 negative. But, you know, I at that point, I was teaching martial arts full time. That was my full time job. I was making very little money. And I had this dream that I wanted to go to Japan, you know, because of the martial arts, really. And I decided to go. And, you know, but I think at that point, at 28 years old, I looked at my life and I was like, wow, you know, you're in debt. You don't really, you have a college degree. I had a college degree in Asian religion. You know, so not the most marketable degree. And so I really needed to get my life together. And that actually started by a trip to the bookstore. I found a book called The Complete Idiot's Guide to Getting Rich. And as cheesy as it sounds, it was actually a really good guide, step-by-step kind of financial freedom before the FIRE movement. And I just started following the lessons as I moved to Japan. And so when I first came out here, at about 28 years old, I was just working as a children's teacher in Japan. So, you know, a lot of people know you can come out here and teach English. It's really easy to get a job if you're a native English speaker, but it's not highly paid. It's like $30,000 a year. But you know, I followed the steps in the book and just kind of worked my way through, and you know, basically saving money, starting with index fund investing, getting to a point where I could earn more by earning a master's degree and then a doctorate degree, eventually becoming a university professor. And about 6 years ago, I started with real estate, and that's really what accelerated my growth. So that kind of takes me to today. I'm 43 years old. I'm married to a Japanese woman, lived here 14 years, as you said, and a little over $1 million in net worth with both my real estate and index funds.
Right on. What a background. So, you know, with your name being Daniel, I'm sure you get this all the time, right? And the martial arts drove you to Japan. So
yeah.
Anybody ever nickname you, call you anything?
Yeah. So I am tied to that movie in so many ways. I am the Karate Kid. So just a couple of funny ones. First of all, my name is Daniel Mills. Remember Allie with an I, Mills,
yeah.
Right? I was born in New Jersey. I moved out to Southern California from New Jersey, and I started training in martial arts schools. And the first instructor I had is the referee in The Karate Kid. You can see him in the background. And so, he was the fight choreographer and all that type of stuff. And eventually, when I was teaching martial arts in my late 20s, I actually taught Jaden Smith, you know, who became the next Karate Kid.
Right.
So I have a lot of ties to that movie. I love it.
That's so cool. So did you ever reach out to Ralph Macchio and be like, hey man, where's my royalties? Cause like, this is basically my story.
I know I should. I was comparing stories with one of my karate teachers, and he was like, you're too young. You missed the boat. I'm the Karate Kid. You know, he was telling me all his links to the story. So yeah, I think I missed it by a few years. I can't claim the story.
It's all good. It's pretty funny though. One of my favorite movies as a kid growing up. So, it's funny too. Just all the ties that you have to it. You know, just really awesome. I knew some of that already, and I wanted to get that out there with some of the listeners here to get a little bit more of a background on you. Just I think that's super cool. You know, and then, you know, you moved out to Japan, and you know, your passion for martial arts brought you out there. And you met your wife when you moved there, right?
So that's I did. Awesome. I did. It sounds like a really sleazy story, actually, because she was, I was teaching at an Aikawa where mostly I taught children, but we did teach some adults in the evenings. And she was working at a hospital, Red Cross Hospital, right next door. And they had a class. And it was like the very first day she came in, I was like, I'm going to marry her, you know? So I spent about 3 months hitting on her before I got a first date, but
okay.
So it was pretty early on in the process.
Right, so you didn't have to fight anybody to the death, right?
No. Okay. I did meet her.
Carry on part two of the Karate Kid.
No, I should have. Yeah. Chosen or something. No, I did meet. I know when I met her parents, that was a funny thing. Her parents, starting with her grandfather right after World War II, owned a ramen shop. I met her dad, and he's just like the typical, you know, just really stern Japanese father. And I went out and I was talking to him while he was making chashu, like the pork. And he used to actually do it on a fire outside. And I was asking him some questions, and he kind of like this. And my wife's like, oh, he loves you. And I was like, oh, that's great. Couldn't tell.
That's awesome. Okay. Awesome. Cool. I had to get that out there. I see some of your stuff on social media. It's just, you know, when I saw that one picture you put up of the guy who was the coach in the Karate Kid, I was like, that is super cool. Okay. So let's get onto the topic of why you're here.
Yeah.
So I'd like to know, like, what, when you moved to Japan, right? You moved there, you were in debt. You didn't have like the highest paying job, and now you had to find a place to live and everything, right? So what got you started on your financial freedom journey?
Yeah. So as I said, you know, I followed the steps in the book, and one of the first steps was starting to save money. So I had my job, and the method that I used was I opened two bank accounts, and when I got paid every month, I put what I was going to save in the separate bank account first. And then I only lived off of what was left. And one of the misnomers about Japan is that it's a very expensive place to live. And that may have been the case back in the 1980s and 90s during the boom, but it's actually not very expensive to live. You can find apartments like in central Tokyo for $500 a month. You're going to be living in a box. It's going to be small, but you can find it. And so I started off in Osaka. I was living cheaply. I got my job. And the first year, you know, was just about saving. I didn't do anything extra, but I learned pretty quickly that I needed to earn more money. And that's what I started working on next, was trying to find those extra jobs that could start increasing my income. And there was a little bit of a kind of a perfect storm of timing here, because it was right when the financial crisis hit, by the time I was here, about a year or two in. And so a lot of Japanese large companies were suffering, and they were getting relief from the government, where they were offering, if you did training like English language lessons or something, that you could earn, they could pay like half their salaries. So I started booking jobs in addition to my children's teaching, where I was doing like 300 person lessons in a factory, and earning $100 an hour and teaching there, you know, 6 hours a day on my days off. So I was making quite a lot of money after a while, just kind of putting it all together and just saving it, sending it home. And it was just going into index funds, just total stock market index.
Right on. So, yeah, I mean, and that's pretty conservative, you know, putting it into index funds. But for someone who, you know, hasn't been saving their money, I mean, that's a great way to get started, right?
Yeah.
Now, I like what you said, how you opened up another bank account and you split your money up. You know, you said, this is the money that's going to get saved. So, for future investments and just for me to save up. And then I'm going to live off of what's left over in the account. And I do something very similar. I do sinking funds, right? So I actually have like 7 bank accounts. And as soon as I get paid, my paycheck immediately gets dispersed. And then I feel like I'm broke because all my money is in all these other accounts. And then, you know, the first thing I pay is my investments. After that, I pay all the other accounts, and then I pay my bills. And that's just the way that I've been doing it. And it's worked out pretty awesome so far. So that is definitely a great method to get started. So I like hearing that other, you know, when other people do that too, because it makes me feel a little less crazy.
And so my bank accounts have grown since that time. You know, at first it was just 2, but now I have one that goes, it pays off my mortgage. I do own my home in Japan. So, you know, my mortgage gets paid immediately. And then I have another one that gets sent to the United States, and another one that's like sort of a savings here. And then finally my checking that I use for my day-to-day spends.
Right on. So speaking of owning a home in Japan, you also own real estate back in the States. So I want to ask you, what are some of the pros and cons of investing in real estate while living abroad?
Yeah. So I'll start off with, so let me just, I'll back up a little bit to where my story started, I think, with real estate. Again, goes back to my book, my origin story with the Idiot's Guide, right? The next phase after index funds was looking at starting a business or doing real estate. And so I was very interested in that, but I had no idea how I was going to get started. And I just kind of put it out there. And the first property I bought back in the States was because I had a friend who I went to high school with, and he owned some property in Boise, Idaho. And I knew nothing. I didn't do a market analysis. I didn't know what I was supposed to be doing, but I thought, you know, he's a lawyer. Him and his lawyer friends are all using the same agent, the same property manager. I'm going to be safe. And I was. It was a great investment. It's probably the best investments I've made to this day. But that's how I got started. Now, when it comes to the pros and cons, the cons are, first of all, as you get deeper into this and you start to do market analysis, try to find properties, you're doing all of this not just at a distance, but in a different time zone. And getting that all together and doing it, being able to move quickly on properties, it's really about building a team backed where you're going to invest. And so that's the main thing that I've worked on, is creating a team. And I do things a little bit different. Like, you know, David Green has of Bigger Pockets has that book, The Long Distance Real Estate Investor. And in the book, he talks about, you know, finding a real estate agent first. What I've found is finding a property manager first is the key, because the property manager is going to be more honest with you on, you know, all the particulars of the property, because they're going to have to manage it. Whereas the agent possibly could just, you know, it's a one-off deal. So, you know, hopefully that's not the way they're thinking, but I like to back everything up with the property manager who's going to actually be managing. And then I get that manager to help me find the other key members of my team. And then after that, it's just about keeping these people happy. So I am constantly giving in referrals to all of the people on my team. When I close on a deal, I do things that are a little bit above and beyond. For example, we'll probably talk about it later, but one of my bigger deals was a 20 duplex portfolio I bought with some partners. And when we closed, all of the properties were built in like 1912. And I actually bought woodblock prints from Japan that were from 1912, like original 1912 woodblock prints. And the seller got them. All of the main agents got them. You know, so all the people in the thing. So I do things like that to just keep people really interested in continuing to work with me.
So I want to jump on that real quick, because, you know, what's funny, I like that you did that, because, you know, you see a lot of times real estate agents will be the ones buying gifts for their clients when they purchase a property. You purchased the properties and bought your real estate agent and the other team members' gifts. So that's kind of like the opposite of some of the things you normally see done. So that's very interesting, and probably a good tactic that some, you know, investors can use in the future. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. And, you know, we even send, I usually get, before COVID, when it was a little bit easier, but I'll get, like in Japan, it's famous for all the flavors of Kit Kat. And I always send like the Kit Kats to the office. So, you know, even the, maybe not the major players are getting something too. And I've just found, as you do this over the number of years, you just get deals that you normally wouldn't get deals on. People call me first about things because they remember me. So, you know, the con, first of all, as I said, timing is an issue. Dealing with the time difference, I usually deal with that with making a really great team with boots on the ground. Other part of it that's really hard in an international setting is signing. It's harder if you're a civilian. So if you're in the military on base, you can get access to a notary. But for civilians, you need to go to the embassy or the consulate. And it costs about $50 per seal at the consulate. So a typical house is going to be 7 seals. It's about double, I think, than what you'd spend in the US. And it's very hard to get appointments.
I spend like $20 to $50 when I get finding out here. That's
So it's like $350 or something, right? $300. Yikes. So yeah, you know, there's definitely logistical things like that. Now in COVID, it's actually a little bit better because a lot of them are doing online notaries or powers of attorney that you can do with a friend back home. So there's ways to do that. The pro of doing it from the distance, and I think this is one of the biggest ones that I see, is so many people get so invested in properties. You know, you meet people that are like, I only invest within a 5-mile radius of my house. I want to know what's going on all the time. Well, I can't do that. So I have to create systems in order to deal with any eventuality. I've had 2 houses burned to the ground since I've been doing this, and that's only in 6 years, right?
Wow.
And it's not as much of a nightmare as people think. These type of things get dealt with. Your property manager is there to deal with it. The other people, you know, so I'm not going to rush into the house and save the building. So there's no need for me to be there at that time.
Right. And that's what insurance is for, right?
Yeah. And, you know, to be honest, I think I learned why the mafia used to burn down buildings for insurance, because in both cases, while I didn't intend it, the properties, you know, it was much better for me once they burned down, because you get all your rent covered while they're rebuilding the property. I get a brand new building. In one case, we couldn't build a new building, but we paid off the loan and sold the land. So in both cases, it was profitable. You know, again, not telling anybody to burn down a building, but it's but all of these things that are sort of nightmare scenarios to a lot of investors are usually not as bad as you think.
Yeah, I mean, there's mitigations and there's mechanisms to, you know, to mitigate some of those costs and expenses that you deal with that, you know, and sometimes you have to trust the insurance agency to just do the right thing and make sure they uphold and give you the value of the property as you're insured for.
Yeah.
So, and the rebuild costs and everything. So yeah, right on. So with you had mentioned how some people that you know that like other investors, they tend to only want to invest like within a 5-mile radius. You know, one of the things you can't do that when you're abroad. So have you found yourself in situations where you're able to take not advantage, but or use that to your advantage? Like, you know, other investors that, hey, I want to buy some more properties in my local area. I don't have the capital right now, or I don't have the resources, you know, and then you have an opportunity to say, hey, I'll partner up with you to help you buy in that local market so you can stay in the area. And now you have an in-house property manager. Have you ever done anything like that?
I've done some similar things, but not exactly. So for example, I have bought a few properties actually with partners. In terms of the most recent one was actually another professor here in Japan. And the reason I teamed up with him is because I've run out of loan slots for, a single family properties or small multi. And so I wanted to use his loan slot. He was happy to, we actually built a duplex and we did that. I even have a couple properties with my mom because she has the loan slots. So I'm kind of helping her. But in terms of finding somebody who could do the property management or the fix up, the closest I have to that is a 12-plex deal that I did in Huntsville, Alabama. And it wasn't just me alone. It was originally I was working with a couple of partners. One is in Hawaii. One was actually in San Francisco. And we found a building, a 12-plex, actually, when one of my partners was on a trip to Huntsville. And we found at least one. There was actually two local partners that we wanted in on it with us, because even though we have a property management, it's always great to have some boots on the ground that are managing the manager. And so that's been a real help in that case. I also, the other deal we did before that is we bought a 20, it was actually 19 duplexes, not 20. I always round up. 19 duplexes that we bought in a historic district in Huntsville, Alabama. And it was me and my two other partners, which are all in a different area, but we teamed up with the realtor. And we basically gave him 10% of the property, and he manages the managers, and he's done it. It's been really helpful with those, because those are lower end properties with a lot more trouble. So we have done it on a few occasions, but personally from like my single families or anything, I just haven't done it yet, but I'd definitely be open to it.
Right on. I wasn't sure, cause I felt like that was a pretty good, you know, it gives you like, I guess a better vantage point, right? Cause you know, you're the experienced investor and there's somebody that wants to invest in their local market. They don't want to really look outside of that market, but they're kind of new and, you know, that might be an opportunity. Now for some of our listeners that might not know what you mean by those loan slots, can you explain what that is?
Yeah. So typically when we're talking about conventional loans, which you're going to get the best rate and best terms on those, you have this is backed by, you know, the federal government, Fannie, Freddie loans. You're going to get 10 loan slots. So usually your personal residence is going to count as one. And one of the very strange things that, again, this is about living abroad, my house in Japan counts as one, which is very strange to me because it's a Japanese bank that has the loan on it, but they do consider it one. So I only had 9 loan slots in the US. And these are for 1 to 4 unit properties. So I ran out of those slots actually within the first 2 to 3 years, I think, of starting to invest. And then when I was still investing more actively, first of all, I looked at commercial. So we did the 20 duplex portfolio actually with owner financing, and the 12 plex was a normal commercial loan. But I also did some team ups, like I said, with my mom and one other friend, where we used their loan slot to acquire the property. And then we quit claimed it into our personal names, or actually our living trusts is what we've been using.
Let's take a brief moment to hear from our show sponsors. What's going on, Average Joes? We know that managing one account or your entire family's portfolio can be stressful and time-consuming. From building and maintaining spreadsheets, calculating how many new shares and units you need to purchase with your contributions, finding the time to log into your brokerage and make those trades, and annually rebalancing each account. Well, my friends over at Passive came up with a tool that can help you manage all of this in a fraction of time without spreadsheets and manual calculations. Passive is a portfolio management tool that makes it easier for DIY investors to maintain a balanced portfolio and build a passive investment strategy at their online broker. It eliminates the need to use spreadsheets, saves you from having to log into your broker to place trades, and helps you stick to your portfolio's target allocation. Elite users can save even more time by using the one-click trades feature and having Passive execute the required trades on your behalf. All of this can be done from the Passive dashboard for all of your accounts. No more logging in to multiple brokerage accounts. Passive is not a robo-advisor. It won't tell you what you should invest in, so you'll need to decide that for yourself, either through self-education or alongside a financial advisor. To learn more about Passive or to sign up, check out our link below, www.averagejoefinances.com/passive. That's P-A-S-S-I-V with no E. Again, P-A-S-S-I-V with no E. Check them out. Hey, what's going on, everybody? It's Mike Cav from Average Joe Finances. Just want to talk to you today about Prep Agent. If you're interested in learning how to become a real estate agent and being able to pass the test on your first try, check out Prep Agent. Check out the link below in the show notes or in the video description. Let's get back to today's episode.
You're listening to the Average Joe Finances Podcast. Whether it's single or multifamily real estate, the stock market, or side hustles, we discuss it all. Strap in and enjoy the ride.
Right on. Yeah, so that's, you know, you hear about that a lot too. Like people get capped out, right? Because they max out on how many loans they can take out, and they feel like there's no other way. Well, you can get creative. There's other ways to find the loans and find the money out there. And it looks like, you know, you're doing it one of those other ways, which is pretty cool. You know, just teaming up with someone else and then being able to utilize that. So, right on, man. That's awesome. So, back to what we were talking about before. So being that you're living in Japan, right, and you're investing back in the States, how do you select the market, the property, and then, and actually those team members when you build that team when you're investing back in the States? Can you walk us through maybe one of the deals that you've done?
Okay, yeah. So I think one thing that's really interesting about property selection or market selection is that it's not one thing for every person. So sometimes I see people, you know, someone buys a property and they say, that's not a good deal. I would never buy that deal. Or, you know, I can't get that in my market or whatever it may be. But you got to understand what the goal is. And so there's kind of a few goals that I've worked on over the years as I've gone. So one kind of maybe little pro about investing in Japan is up until this year, this is actually the final year, we've had this incredible tax deduction on our Japanese side of the taxes, where if you buy properties that are over 20 years old and they're a wood structure property, you can deduct the entire price of the structure against your salary. So, you know, just as an example, I buy a $100,000 property. Every year I can take $25,000 off my salary. So part of my mindset, and I think that's important to remember, is that I've had this in mind because I've been trying to get the highest tax deduction. So in certain ways, I might have bought properties that other people were like, nah, it's not enough cash flow. But I've also selected a few markets where I'm really looking at cash flow. So just to give an example, I think Huntsville is one of my big markets right now. So I first heard about Huntsville, Alabama, on a podcast. I heard somebody say, you know, it's like one of the best kept secrets. She knew what she was doing. She works in a bunch of markets. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. I got to look into it. And I don't know. Have you ever heard of Neil Bawa?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. So Neil,
he offers
like
a really good
scientist.
Free course, by the way.
Yeah. That's what I was going to mention. So I actually took his course on Udemy. That's about market analysis. It's called Real Focus. Free course. It takes an hour. And I use a lot of those to identify markets. So Huntsville was one of those. And actually, it doesn't quite meet his criteria. You know, he's got very high criteria of what markets should be that he invests in. But, you know, you adjust it for you. But that's what I did. Once I identified that market, and at that time, I was looking to buy a lot. I was looking at multifamily. But so this was a little bit further in my journey. But I knew I needed to get into the market first. So the first thing I did is I started asking around. I started asking locals on BiggerPockets and other forums, you know, who are the people I need to know in the Huntsville market? And one name that kept coming up was this guy, John Brooks. He's a real estate agent. He does a lot of builds. He flips. He does some other stuff. So I contacted him. And again, you know, playing the long game, I started off just trying to find a single family house with him. I thought, you know, I'm going to build trust. I'm going to buy a single family, and then we'll bring in the bigger deals, you know? So I went through the process with him. I showed him that I'm reliable. I can close on a single family. I wanted to see how he worked, and we got to know each other really, really well. And that's when, at that point, after I bought that house through him, I was able to, and he brought on all the other team members, you know, to go back to your question. So when I contacted him, usually I say property manager first, but just in this case, I did get an agent first. He was also a property manager, so that helped.
David Green would be also proud. Brought on,
yeah, he did. We did need to do some fix up to the property. So, you know, I talked to him about that, and he had a crew because he builds houses and everything. So we went with his crew and just, you know, went through the whole process with him. And the great thing is, as I said, the next deal he brought us was, you know, $1.5 million 19 duplex portfolio that he actually partnered with us on it. So I think that's kind of the key there is really I start with market and I go to the people, and it's really about building those relationships over time.
Yeah. I mean, that's the most important thing. I think one of the keys here is just that relationship building and building rapport with everyone that you have on your team and just everyone that you bring into your circle that you're working with. Right. Man, that's good stuff. So, you know, with going back and, you know, doing some of these deals that you've been doing back in the States, right, while you're in Japan, you know, I can't get over the fact, you know, cause I kind of deal with the same thing, investing back in Virginia and I'm in Hawaii, but for me, it's like a 5-6 hour difference. For you, it's like a whole day, right? Realistically, yeah. But you know, that still very large hourly time difference, right? So with that, there's probably some things that might be time late that you always, you know, can't respond to everything right away, right? I've realized that too, even being here in Hawaii. So with that comes different kinds of risks, right? So, but besides that, just there's always risks in any type of investment, especially in real estate, right? There's all kinds of different risks. So in talking about risk, what are some strategies that you've used to mitigate risk in your investments?
Yeah, I think one of the big things for me has been diversification. And this may be another pro, if we're going to go back to that, of investing from a distance and not being emotionally attached to a specific market. So, you know, I don't have to look at one market or one property type because I'm looking at the entire United States, you know, for my investments, and I can target those different markets. So like in my portfolio, I kind of separated out from my personal portfolio, which are mostly single family houses and a couple duplexes, to my more commercial portfolio, which I have usually with partners. But in my personal portfolio, I have a number of houses in Memphis, Tennessee. These are my core cash flow properties. They're in C-class neighborhoods, but they're good tenants. Most of my tenants have been with me since day one for like 5 years. I have nine of them now, and they provide this cash flow every month, and they cover my mistakes or my chances that I take in other markets. Then I have a couple of other markets that are for a different reason. So my Huntsville market is kind of a hybrid. When I invest there, I'm getting some cash flow. There's still some deals to be had, but I'm really looking at that appreciation working in as well, because there's so many good market factors with Huntsville. It's the new headquarters for Space Command. They've had the rocket center there forever. You know, NASA, the Army, all of the contractors, the businesses that go along with that are there. So it's a great market, and we're seeing incredible appreciation. And then finally, and I didn't know this at the time, but it was kind of a lucky break, I invested in Boise, Idaho, and that's become almost a pure appreciation market. I mean, I think it's the next Seattle. It's just to give you an example, the two properties I bought there, $120,000. They're now worth $310,000.
Wow.
In 5 years. And so I've been able to refinance those and then use that to invest in higher cash flow markets. And so we have all of these working at the same time, right? You know, you've got the cash flow, you've got the hybrid market, and then you've got a pure appreciation market that's acting almost like a bank to buy the higher cash flow properties. And so I think that type of thing, really that diversification of geography and even the property type to a certain extent, like in Boise, Idaho, the ones that I have are 5-bedroom, 2.5 baths, just because the area where I'm invested, there's a lot of bigger families. That's what seemed to work out. Whereas I think mostly 3-2s, maybe 3-1s in Memphis. So, you know, different type of property. And then once I got into the commercial side, I've been able to target different types of properties in different areas with that as well. Currently, I'm looking at industrial, self-storage, senior living, some of these other ways to diversify.
Yeah, and diversification seems to definitely be the key. So even in just your regular everyday investing in real estate, you're very diversified, right? So you've got your high cash flowing properties, you have your properties that have extreme appreciation, which we can all appreciate appreciation. It's an amazing thing. And then you're doing these cash out refinancing, you know, financing those loans and taking that money and buying more cash flowing properties. So just adding up to your passive cash flows. That's really awesome. That's good deal, man. So you buy all these, you know, real estate properties back in the States. And actually, before I get into this, you said you're also looking at self-storage now and other avenues. Have you purchased any of those deals yet, or are you still just looking to get started?
Yeah, I'm just looking, to be honest. There's been a little bit of a switch, and I think it's come. I think there's sort of a stages of investing that I notice. You know, of course, when I was in my early 30s and whatnot, I was willing to lose sleep and be really active. As I've gotten into my 40s, and my wife is also on board with this, she doesn't want me taking phone calls at 2 a.m. because I'm having to work on a deal. So we've moved a little bit more to the passive investing. So I've bought active deals here and there, but in the last year, I invested in two passive syndications for multifamily. But I think COVID made me think about the risk that we do have from legislation, right? The moratorium on evictions, things like this. I thought to myself, you know, even though I'm diversified, I'm not diversified out of residential. And so that's sort of been my next step. And really what I've been looking for are passive syndications. And I found a few that I find really interesting, but I'm still kind of in the vetting process. And I'm also looking to get some more money that's coming back to me from a sale and things like that. So hopefully this year we're going to get some more diversification with those other property types.
Yeah, that's a fantastic way to look at it, right? Because you're looking at this whole picture. you know, you're looking, especially, you know, lessons learned from 2020, right? What a painful year that was, but it wasn't painful for everybody. Cause you know, some of us had some great success in 2020. But some of us had a lot of pain, right? And you know, that's to come when there's a, you know, a worldwide pandemic. So you're looking at other avenues that's going to bring in that same type of cash flow without the residents, right? Without having to deal with tenants and things of that nature. So definitely a smart way of looking at it. That's awesome. So where I was trying to go before, right? So I had mentioned, you know, you're doing all these investments back in the States and you live in Japan. So I know you have a primary residence that you bought in Japan, but why not invest in Japan since you live there?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a really good question and I'm not against investing in Japan. I actually have a plan that maybe in the future I would buy some properties. The thing with Japan, which is it's an extremely strange real estate market. I don't think it's similar anywhere else in the world. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there's somewhere else. But basically buying most property in Japan, like a condo or a single family house, is like buying a car back in the United States. It literally depreciates every year. So most
and
of the value-
And this is not like tax write-off depreciation.
No, literal depreciation. So, and when you ask Japanese people, they can't understand why a house that's old would be worth more. You know, to them, it's just like, no, this is an old house. It's like a car, and they just knock them down and they rebuild them. And so it literally depreciates, but not only that, but the rents depreciate over time. So if you have the same tenant for a long time, they'll usually pay the same rent. But when you move them out, you get a new tenant in there. You know, you can't, it's going to be a lower rent if it's 10 years later.
Wow. That is 100% the opposite of how it is here.
Yeah, exactly. So it's difficult to figure out the properties. There's a lot of people that make a lot of money in property and there's ways to do it, but it was more of to wrap my head around that model was very hard in the beginning. And even to this day, figuring that out has been more, I compare apples to apples, I guess. I look at properties in the US and I'm like, well, if I put in 200,000 here in the US, I get the cash flow, I get the appreciation. I get that stable population growth that we have in certain areas. And in Japan, you have a declining population, you have depreciating asset. So again, there's definitely ways to do it. And for example, I have my business partner owns two large apartment buildings in Tokyo. And the reason he says he bought those properties, and this is where it can make sense, is at the time, the banks were offering 110% financing. So he was able to buy the properties with no money down, bank loan. It's like a 2% loan here in Japan. It's a very low interest rate. And he owns these large multi-million dollar apartment buildings in Tokyo. And over time, the debt's getting paid down from the rents and everything. And even with a depreciating property, he's still able to cash those out at the end of a cycle and get the money and earn a lot of money on his zero down investment.
Yeah, but who's going to want to buy that, you know, when it's depreciated so much? I mean, I don't know. Like, that is so weird to me because I guess you're paying down your principal balance, but at the same time, the value of your property is decreasing. That just, it's kind of mind-boggling. Is
the land
there
doesn't
land
decrease.
Value that does the land value increase at all, or does it stay relatively the same? Or
land value does go up, and so that's where you'll see some rising prices or something. So hopefully, if you bought in a good area, it's going to remain stable, or it's at least going to go up. But yeah, you know, it's just things like that. I think where the key in Japan is, I was talking to a guy yesterday who's actually in Korea. And Korea is like the United States. It goes up in value. It's not the same thing. But he had a business model where he was buying self-storage facilities in Korea. And then he had almost like an Airbnb for self-storage. So people use an app and they order a box. And the box comes to their house. They put their winter clothes in it. Somebody picks it up and takes it to self-storage and they pay a monthly fee. And then when they want it back, it comes back. And I thought to myself, like, that's the type of thing in Japan that might work. You know, if you're creative and you're going to be really active, there's a lot of things like that. But I just can't see, like, you know, it's not as simple as paying 200 grand as a down payment to buy a multifamily in Japan. And it's going to be a good deal if I have the opportunity to buy in the U.S. So that's, you know, that's why I've always decided to stick with the U.S.
Okay, right on. So sticking with the topic of Japan. So what are some of the benefits of living in Japan for you as an American?
Yeah. So one thing that I mentioned a little bit earlier is sort of the tax benefits. There's kind of a bad side to that. Japan is one of the few countries in the world that tax on worldwide income and assets. So I have to report everything to Japan. And, you know, for example, if I have a 15% tax in the US on something, even if it's a property I sold or something, but the same tax is 20% in Japan, I have to pay the 15 in America, and then I have to pay the 5% difference in Japan. So I always pay the higher.
This doesn't sound like benefits right now, man.
I don't know what
the benefits are.
I know. I'm answering a different question, but I'm just going to say there are things like that that are not good, but
that
the benefit.
Painful.
Yeah, there's an exit tax. There's lots of other things that are not great with Japan, but the benefits are things like these hidden depreciation, like I told you about, because Japanese properties, like I said, most of the value is in the land. They had this crazy loophole where they were like, well, yeah, if it's 20 years old, you can depreciate the structure, you know, in 4 years. So if you buy US properties, you can get that. So basically, for the last 5 or 6 years, I've been living tax free in Japan, even though I earn a six-figure salary at my job, because I've been able to buy US property and depreciate that directly against my salary. So that's one of the benefits. In addition to that, the United States is one of the only countries that doesn't have a national healthcare system, right? And, you know, Japan has a great healthcare system. I have a couple of like long-term injuries and things like that. I know when I was in the US, I was taking some medication. It was $300 a month with insurance. That same medication in Japan cost me $10 a month, you know, with the insurance. So we have this security of the long-term benefit, and it's just really a nice, safe place to live. And my job that I do, I couldn't beat it. I couldn't get it in the United States, even if I had an equivalent level job. So those are all the reasons, you know, I love living here despite some of the issues with the taxes and dealing with that.
Wow. Yeah. That's definitely some great benefits, but man, you were starting that off with some of those negative, some of those cons. I was like, ooh, why are you staying there? That's a lot of taxes.
Yeah,
but I mean, essentially the last 5 years tax-free, that's awesome, man. It's really good stuff.
So you can do really well.
What are you going to do when this benefit goes away?
So that's the thing. This is the last year that the benefit goes away. My wife is a certified financial planner, so she's quite on top of all of the, you know, the tax laws. Unfortunately, they haven't told us what's going to replace it. So there's a possibility that we'll still be able to, we can't depreciate the foreign properties, but we can still take the tax deductions, you know, on capital expenses or mortgage interest or things like this. So if that's still in place, we'll still get about half the benefit, but it has changed my strategy. That's one of the reasons I'm not even that interested in active acquisitions right now and more in the passive side, because there's no real benefit for me to buying personally. You know, kind of, again, I keep veering off to the side a bit, but sort of an interesting thing, to get this tax deduction, you actually had to buy in your personal name. So for my personal portfolio, none of that's in an LLC, and we're actually not allowed to even transfer it to an LLC because, again, the Japanese tax system considers that a sale, and you'll have to pay capital gains and recapture if you do that. So Ouch. We got it. We actually keep it in our living trust, which we got approved as, you know, still our personal name. But as we go to the next stage where they're not going to give you the deductions anyway, that's also going to change maybe how we structure things in the future. There's a lot of benefits here to buying in an LLC. We haven't been able to get a right answer about this with foreign property, but it seems that you can avoid the inheritance tax with LLC ownership, because if I don't have any kids, but there is an inheritance tax here with your wife, unfortunately, too, which is crazy. But if you die, if I die and I leave her an LLC, they'll consider it a family business and probably pass it on without an inheritance tax. So, yeah, so all of these sort of factors, you know, we're just kind of dealing with them as they come and trying to figure out what the next step is.
Yeah, well, it's good thing your wife's in the finance business there, because she could stay on top of that and making sure you guys are doing everything the right way and not having to worry about getting hit with all that. That's sheesh. So definitely highly taxed, but there's some great advantages to mitigate a lot of that. So that's good stuff, man. Okay. So I've got two more things I want to ask you, right? This next one, it's going to be a little personal. Okay. So
yeah.
What's the biggest mistake you've made as an investor?
So I've made quite a few. I have one that's, let me see. I think the best one here. I think the biggest mistake that I've made as an investor is chasing the 1% rule. I think that's a big one. I started off, as I said, in Boise, and I bought two properties at the 1% rule. And, you know, I just started listening to Bigger Pockets, and I kept hearing the 2% rule, right? But then they, you know, they moved it to the 1% rule. And I was thinking, you know, that's what it is. And as the market started increasing in value, you know, 135, a property's 135, but you're only getting $1,200 a month in rent. And I was like, oh, that's not the 1% rule. So I started going to markets that would fit that criteria. And what I didn't realize was the whole package. You know, at that time, I was just looking at cash flow, and cash flow is super important. You know, it's your lifeblood. If you don't have cash flow, you're done. You got to have some of that cash flow, but it's not everything. And as I've gotten further and further, I've realized that the increase in net worth and you know, equity is really allowed me to build wealth at a faster pace, because you can always tap that equity to get it and go somewhere else. But cash flow is not always as good as it seems. It seems good in the beginning, but once you're already set, you know, it's not, I don't feel it's the right way to go. And so I think I turned down a lot of deals early on chasing that cash flow. And I wish I hadn't have done that. I wish I had thought bigger picture.
Yeah. I mean, cause one of the things to think about too, you're saying, you know, that one property was 135 and it was only bringing in 1200 a month, but you know, what was your down payment looking like? What was the interest rate on that property looking like? So what was the honest, like, cash on cash ROI, right? So yeah, that's a great thing. There's a lot of stuff to keep in mind when you're looking at these different deals, and maybe, you know, setting that standard of using the 1% rule. I mean, that could be a, you know, a great way for people to filter different things. Like, everybody has like their factors, right? Their deal factors. What's going to make them, you know, go in on a deal, and what's going to make them back away from a deal. So I guess you might have missed out on some opportunity with that, you know, calling that your biggest mistake. Then if that was your biggest mistake, then dude, that's awesome, because that's nothing too crazy. So that's really good.
My biggest weakness is that I try too hard. Yeah.
I've heard that before. All right. Awesome. Yeah. So now I've got the most important question for you, right? And that is, where can people find more information about you? Do you have a website you could share with us, or social media?
I don't really. You know, I'm a full-time professor, so you can easily find stuff about that in my research. But in terms of financing and investing, I'm mostly on Facebook, and I'm on several groups in Facebook. I'm really active on Bigger Pockets Money and the regular Bigger Pockets, but mostly the Facebook groups. I do go on to the sites here and there. I'm in a few of the military groups. As I said, I didn't have a big military career, but because of the type of discharge I got, I do get military benefits. And because of that, I am on some of the military groups on Facebook and anything to do with Honolulu, because I'm out there quite a lot for business.
Awesome. Yeah, I've seen you in a bunch of those groups, including the Average Joe Finances network as well. So definitely appreciate your participation and just everything that you're doing. I mean, I've been following your journey on social media and just getting to know you like this past year, because we're in a similar group that meets up once a month via Zoom. And every time we get into a breakout room together, I'm like, cool, what's Daniel going to talk about this time?
the next Karate Kid.
It's really awesome stuff, man. So, hey, I just want to say I really appreciate you coming on and talking with us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Absolutely.
Thanks for listening to the Average Joe Finances Podcast, your source for beating debt, saving money, and investing. Learn more at averagejoefinances.com.
The Average Joe Finances Podcast is for informational and entertainment purposes only. Do not use this for any real estate or investment making decision.